This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Lisa Brenner, letting you know that my new film, Say My Name, will be available in selected theaters and on demand starting June 14th. It's a madcap British comedy about love, one-night stands, and criminals who shoot themselves in the leg. To find out more, go to the Say My Name Movie Facebook page or simply search the hashtag Say My Name Movie on whatever social media you use, and you might just see me in a sex scene. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, and if you're a fan of the 430 movie, you'll love Best Movies Never Made, hosted by Jodorowsky's Dune producer Steve Scarlatta and Josh Miller, where they explore some of the greatest movies that were never made, from E.T. 2 to Tim Burton's Superman, Night Skies to Star Trek The Academy Years. New episodes available every other Monday, wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, and if you're a fan of Star Trek, check out my new sci-fi TV series, Pandora, debuting on the CW and around the world on July 9th, starring Priscilla Quintana and Oliver Dench, and you can find out more by downloading the Unboxing Pandora podcast, available weekly wherever you listen to podcasts. Get ready to join the Inglourious Trexperts live at San Diego Comic-Con as they boldly go to the greatest Comic-Con on Earth. We'll be there, will you? Meet all your favorite and least favorite Inglourious Trexperts hosts as they talk Trek live and in person only at San Diego Comic-Con. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Doctorman, and we are the Inglourious Trexperts.
Hey, welcome back to another exciting episode of our tribute to Star Trek The Motion Picture's 40th anniversary. And I am just so delighted because we are going to be dealing with a star before time, the great late Jerry Goldsmith.
And
star I
have beyond, some, time, beyond, star beyond time, beyond time,
beyond Antares. we have some great returning guests, some new guests. We got guest galore here. So before we get into continuing our 40th anniversary celebration, I want to introduce you once again. The writer of Thor and X-Men First Class. He was a writer-producer on Black Sails and Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. Ashley E. Miller is back.
Hello.
Welcome, Ashley. And we also have our, who better to talk about the music of Star Trek The Motion Picture than the man who wrote the book, literally wrote the book, The Music of Star Trek. That man, he's been a guest on our sister podcast many times, Disco Nights, but now he's in the A-list. Now he's in the major leagues. he's here for the big shoe. Mr. Jeff Bond. Welcome, Jeff.
I finally made it. Thank you.
And
thank
I want to say that Jeff has a remarkable new book out called The Fantasy Worlds of Irwin Allen. It is available via, what's the URL?
Creaturefeatures.com.
Creaturefeatures.com. And check it out because it is a beautiful, beautiful book. If you're a fan of Irwin Allen, you got to check it out. You know, Jeff's done other books like The World of the Orville and The Making of Narcos, but this is just a whole nother level of awesomeness. So check it out. And Now, he's back. Now, you're probably still recovering from the last time he was on. He was so great and so candid and was just a great guest. He was a creator of Film Score Monthly. He is a film music scholar and producer, and he's done a zillion liner notes, and one of my favorite guests we've ever had on the show, Mr. Lucas Kendall, is back.
Well, hello. Thank you. Didn't think I'd be back, but...
No, are you kidding? How could we not have you back? We did an episode a while ago on the music of Star Trek where we talked about the original series and, of course, subsequent shows where the music's less impressive. But
it was explosive.
It was an explosive episode.
Well, I can do that again. Just let me know where the dial
is. Great guest. But, you know, we realized, you know, as we were making our way, and we've done some great shows on the 40th anniversary of Star Trek The Motion Picture. We had Walter Koenig here talking about Chekhov's Enterprise. We had Mike Matesino and David Fine here to talk about the wonderful Director's Edition. We've done a bunch of episodes now on Star Trek The Motion Picture 40th. But we would be remiss if we didn't talk about one of the great motion picture scores of all time made under the most difficult of circumstances. And of course, I'm referring to Jerry Goldsmith's brilliant Star Trek The Motion Picture score. I still have the LP from when I was a kid.
Sure.
I don't think the grooves are still there because I played it so many
worn
times.
Worn out the grooves.
Wore out the grooves of that LP. Of course, it's been reissued many times. The most recent and certainly the best is La La Land's remarkable
three disc set.
They also reissued, I believe, an LP of it, if I'm not mistaken. It is a remarkable. So if you are inspired to go out and seek out this music after listening to the show, I strongly suggest you go to lalalandrecords.com and get the Star Trek The Motion Picture 3 limited edition 3 CD set, which is just phenomenal. But I want to turn it over to the experts now. These are guys who can tell you why this is such an extraordinary motion picture soundtrack, but also made under the most difficult of circumstances. So
yes, tell us of this music.
I think that Jerry Goldsmith might have been, after Robert Wise, one of the first major talents hired to work on Star Trek The Motion Picture. He was a very kind of important part of the package once it started becoming the motion picture and, you know, wasn't Star Trek Phase II, the television series, or whatever the previous iterations of it were. And there were, you know, we looked at memos when we were working on the three-disc CD set. We got to see a bunch of materials at USC, I think. And, some of the memos, you know, were addressing very specifically the music aspect. You know, way before they got rolling, they talked about the fact that this movie would be a great opportunity to showcase music, and that there would be, you know, extended visual sequences there wouldn't be a lot of wouldn't be a lot of dialogue, and the music would really be driving the story. Mm-hmm. Jerry Goldsmith, I think at this point people always kind of think of John Williams as the, you know, premier film composer and the most popular film composer, which he is, and he ultimately became. At this point in time, John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith were more kind of jockeying for position, and they were both getting, you know, very big A-list movie projects. But there's kind of a continuing saga of Jerry Goldsmith always getting kind of the leftovers of John Williams' projects. And this is a big example. As much as we love Star Trek The Motion Picture, it was somewhat in the shadow of Star Wars. You know, Star Wars came out in 1977.
Heard of it.
The score to Star Wars, you know, became one of the greatest selling albums of all time, one of the most popular pieces of music, period, let alone film music.
And one of the great gatefold sleeves of ALP.
Yeah, exactly. So it had a big influence. I'm sure that's one of the reasons that they were thinking about, you know, the opportunity to showcase music in Star Trek The Motion Picture, was that there had been this previous, you know, record-breaking space movie with a magnificent film score in it. So, Jerry Goldsmith had a great reputation as a composer of science fiction music. Mm-hmm. He'd done music for the Twilight Zone. He'd done this weird kind of chase movie about a man-made virus called the Satan bug that has a just a bizarre, fantastic score. Then he did, you know, Planet of the Apes, The Illustrated Man, and Logan's Run. So he was kind of the go-to guy before John Williams. If you thought about scoring a science fiction movie, you would get Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm.
So, Lucas, you know, one of the things we alluded to is this was a, you know, we've talked in the past about the troubles with Star Trek The Motion Picture having to make a release date, but never was this more of a problem than for the composer, Jerry Goldsmith. Can you talk a little bit about what a struggle it was to deliver a score and what a remarkable achievement it was to produce this kind of music on this kind of schedule?
Indeed, I can do this. I'm very qualified to do this.
hence your credits.
Please begin.
So music, film music, it comes last because the movie needs to be done. It needs to be locked. And they had no locked movie, so he was working on the movie. He was on his contract, and he had nothing to do. So it was kind of a maddening process where they would book and they didn't know if they would have music to record. So they hired him in sort of midsummer, and he started on his contract August 1st. And usually the contracts would be 10 weeks. This is the way the old studio deals worked. And they did some of the early scenes that were ready. He actually redid them, which we'll talk about later. And then there were no special effects, so he couldn't write anything. So they would get the big orchestra, the 90-piece or however many piece orchestra, 20th Century Fox, where they recorded because they had a big pipe organ, and they'd have nothing to do. So they'd be spending an incredible amount of money, and they would just re-record the main title because it was better than doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And then when the footage finally came in, he didn't have enough time, so they brought in Fred Steiner, who was a composer for the original series, to ghostwrite basically a handful of cues based on Jerry's themes. They brought in Alexander Courage to do the two versions of the old theme under the captain's log. And then it was just this furious race against time, and they recorded the last pieces of music, the Klingon Battle, only like a week or less than a week before the premiere.
Really? Yeah. I had no idea. That's
we
incredible.
Have a, well, I checked our liner notes before I came here to refresh my memory.
Then it must be true.
Well, yeah, because we had the documentation. And I want to ask Jeff, I didn't see those USC memos. Did they speculate about any composer except for Jerry?
Well, it's interesting you would say that. Not at the USC memos, but I didn't see anything about other composers there. But when I was at the Roddenberry Archives last week, they happened to have a folder of just music memos. And a lot of it was early in the process, and it was a lot of, I think, fan bands, like Star Trek fan bands trying to get the gig.
Oh, my
you know,
boy,
there's
God.
One called, like, Warp 9 or something, submitting ideas. But there was also a letter from, I think, Herbie Hancock's people. And Herbie Hancock apparently was very hot to get the Star Trek The Motion Picture gig, and that would have been a fantastic funk jazz score. I don't think that they ever really considered anyone else. And
certainly not Robert Wise. Robert Wise was his first choice because they'd worked together on the Sandpenders.
Right. Wise wanted him. They had worked together. And I think Roddenberry probably was very much on board too, because Jerry was on a list of composers for the original series that they were going to try to get. And I think, you know, Jerry was under contract to different people and was doing, you know, probably Man from U.N.C.L.E. at the time. But he was, you know, very big both in his kind of early movie career and television at the time. So they couldn't get him for the original series. But I'm sure that Roddenberry, you know, kind of remembered that. And that was a great idea to have him do this movie finally.
And Jerry had won an Oscar for The Omen, which was prestigious. Right. So he was, if it wasn't going to be Williams, which it couldn't be, it was natural that it would be Jerry.
So I've heard two insane stories about the music for this film. The first is that Jerry Goldsmith originally wrote a completely different main title. The second being that there are lyrics to Ilea's theme and Sean Cassidy performed
it. Those are two different questions.
Yeah. Right. That's like sending order of insanity.
He did not really write a different main title, but he wrote a completely different theme.
Right. Okay.
Well, it's not completely.
It's not completely. It's sort of the germ of the idea for what became the theme. And he wrote some of the early cues, the dry dock scene and I think this orbital office complex theme, which still stays in the movie, and a couple other sequences, and it's sort of leaning toward the march theme, but much more flowing, and
it's more of a waltz.
So
it was Robert Wise who bumped on it, right?
Robert Wise did not like it. He felt that he said it reminded him of like Western music because there was this very
Conestoga
sailing ship.
Yeah, both. Yeah. Or maybe he didn't know whether the Conestoga. He did say Conestoga.
Yes,
he said Conestoga wagon.
This is all on the early music and the description of how it came to exist is all in this La La Land package. But so yeah, there was never a main title, but when he started the recording sessions for the footage they did have in August or September, whenever it was, he had a version of the Star Trek theme that was basically the first half. Mm. Went da 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 da, and then it was different from the rest of it.
Okay.
You can sort of hear it still in the movie in some little places under dialogue. But he didn't have...
It was unformed.
It was not the march. He didn't have da 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 da. So it was sort of aquatic. It was more impressionistic.
He had done for Paramount and Robert Evans the same year he did this movie called Players, about which nobody has ever seen, about tennis players. And there are a couple of sequences where they're playing tennis, and he wrote this very energetic, like, tennis music that has like chimes and like it's kind of like fox hunting music, and it's got the same kind of energy actually that the Star Trek march had. And if you kind of follow Goldsmith's career, it's always kind of morphing between projects. You'll hear a little bit of the last project worm its way into this project, and then ideas for his next project are kind of coming up, so that you can he had done
Ava Sitani was the original title.
Yeah, yeah. For... he had done Alien the same year too. You can hear kind of some of the avant-garde effects and the eerie space sounds. You know, you can hear in some of the music for Alien, but then he was also kind of starting to lean in a more romantic direction and kind of leaving. He had this kind of gritty avant-garde style he had done in the 60s and 70s, and Star Trek is kind of his move into a bigger romantic style.
Definitely.
And it lost the Oscar to A Little Romance by George LaRue.
Yeah, somebody, wasn't Bruce Kimmel talking about that apparently Bruce himself
who
had sent out all these LPs or cassettes or something to Academy members for this movie, A Little Romance, another movie no one else has seen.
Right.
That's got this tiny little... I mean, George Delarue is a great composer, but the only music anyone remembers from that score is by another composer. It's some Vivaldi piece. So, but apparently, at least according to Bruce... he was one of the first guys to figure out to send promo copies, and that may have influenced the voters. And supposedly it's also the only, and I can't believe this because Goldsmith lost Oscars for Planet of the Apes and Patton, the most iconic score he probably ever wrote. And he apparently the only time he actually was mad about losing an Oscar was for Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about this because, our good friend Alan Spencer was producing Mork and Mindy on the lot at the time. And he tells the story, of course, of how when he would go by the scoring stage, there was a cot set up for Jerry Goldsmith where he would take naps because he was literally scoring like 24/7 because of how late the cut was delivered and the visual effects coming in late. And I mean, and the famous stories, of course, of him scoring slugs because they didn't have the visual effects. So
slugs
just scoring...
meaning blank film.
Yes,
not the animals.
Exactly, but just black, where it's saying, you know, shot to come, right. And he'd have to conjure up this beautiful music for something that didn't exist.
Yeah, that's one of the kind of outcomes of this, was that because the effects sequences were the last things finished, that they weren't really edited, that they just had all the footage. It's like, here's the footage we have. It's just spliced together. And there was no time to shape a lot of the sequences. And, you know, you always hear people complaining about the dry dock sequence. Why is this dry dock sequence 5 minutes long?
Not us.
It gave Goldsmiths this opportunity to write these long, completely composed pieces of music, which he right. would not have gotten. And there's another thing. There's a great quote in this Return to Tomorrow book, which actually has interview material from Goldsmith at the time, you know, right after yes. he had done the movie. And he just talked about how the process affected his writing. And one of the reasons this is such a great score is something that Goldsmith didn't intend and probably wouldn't have done if he would have just gotten the movie complete. Because Goldsmith's approach was usually to kind of write this nugget of material and base everything off of it, all variations of kind of one piece of material. But because he was working on these disconnected sequences over a long piece of time, he would be kind of focusing on one sequence and would come up with kind of more original musical ideas for those sequences. So what people remember about the Star Trek score is it's got the Klingon music, it has this music for Vulcan, it's got this very flowing space music for the space stations, and then it has this whole incredible kind of sonic world for V'ger. Mm-hmm. That's just this completely alien, imposing weird environment. And that all happened because Goldsmith was working on these sequences so kind of far apart from right. each other. And he said that, he finished the Klingon sequence last, and I think he told Robert Wise at the time that you can hear him start to work his ideas for V'ger. Obviously, V'ger is on screen, the cloud, and when the Klingon ships are going into the cloud, and you kind of hear his ideas for V'ger integrated into that Klingon music. It's integrated into the rhythmic approach of that sequence. And he said, you know, I finally kind of got it and figured it out. By that point, he had had everything in his head so long that he could express it all in a more integrated way. But at the same time, the way he got screwed over in his work process kind of made the score more varied than it probably
was. Well, when I ask Lucas, because not since the Zither and the Third Man or the Theremin and Day of the Earth Stood Still has there been something as distinctive and unique and beloved as the blaster beam in Star Trek The Motion Picture. Can you sort of talk about integrating that into the score and why that was unique at the time?
Sure, I can do that. The blaster beam, which is that thing that when I was a kid, I thought, is that like a bass guitar? And it's actually like this very, very long metal beam with strings on it. And
it kind of is a bass guitar.
Yeah, and it's played with an artillery shell. And it was definitely played by Craig Huxley, who as a child actor, Craig Hunley, was on, he's one of the kids and the children's show lead, right. Little redheaded kid. And
he wasn't the Gorgon.
No. So it was a custom-built thing that had been based on a couple of beams by other musicians. There's a guy named Francisco Lupica, I think. Mm-hmm. And it just had this really cool sound. And Goldsmith in his career always sought out interesting sounds. And he always – it's sort of the easiest and smartest thing you can do as a composer is if you're going to come up with an original melody, well, even more immediate to the audience is just the sound itself. Mm-hmm. So he sought out – there's a percussionist named Emil Richards who has a large, large collection of weird percussion instruments that he's collected from all over the world. And that led to a lot of the weird sounds in Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. Four harps and four pianos in Chinatown. You know, he was a great colorist. And on Star Trek The Motion Picture, he had his full symphony orchestra, but he also had this beam that was used. It was like a concerto for beam and orchestra to give that weird, just alien sound for V'ger. And he also had a lot of at their vintage now, but at the time they were cutting edge synthesizers. Mm. And weird things like, again, the pipe organ at Fox. And I'm trying to think. There for the Klingons, there were some of Emil Richards. They're called their various boobams and onklongs. I don't know the pronunciation. Yeah.
But. And also that he uses some kind of a wiggle board as well in one of the cues.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. I forget what that thing's called. There's also something called a waterphone,
right?
Which is this metal thing with some metal spikes on it
that hear inside. V'ger,
yeah, and you fill right. it with water and you bow it, and it gives that sort of crinkly metal sound. I can't make it with my mouth, and you don't want me to try. But if you're listening to it, you go, "Oh, all right." So he was a brilliant colorist, and the beam was a large part of it. The beam was in a lot of late 70s. It was in Meteor. It was in Prophecy. It was in the Black Hole.
Yeah, it's in the Black Hole.
And then it's in Star Trek. Definitely in Star Trek 2 and 3 by James Horner. And that sort of fell out of fashion, and then it broke. Then he broke it, and like it fell off coming off a truck or something. And when he put it back together, it never quite sounded the same.
I think what I love about the beam, and Goldsmith to me, you know, that instrument is used in these other scores, as Lucas mentioned, but it's just a texture. What I love about Goldsmith's kind of sound things, effects, are they always had kind of like a thought process or an idea behind them. And it's there's a very specific effect and feeling you get from these kind of gong hits. It's terrifying, and it just says immediately that there's this thing that's just huge and incomprehensible. And he said he created this whole kind of language for something that you're supposed to never be able to understand, and it's one of the most effective approaches to characterizing V'ger in the movie.
And one of the great things about it is that not only is it a percussive instrument, but, you know, the big bong hits, quote a phrase, but it also is articulate, much like a steel guitar.
Yeah.
The shell that is used on it is basically you bring it down and you hit it and you bring it up the strings to, you know, make that big boom.
Yeah,
and it's amazing.
Goldsmith loved pitch bends. You can hear that in Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. He used like a bass slide whistle, or kind of invented a bass slide whistle. Or he often used, you know, horns or trombones to make that sound. Mm-hmm. So he loved it. It created this very unsettling kind of, you know, disorienting mm-hmm. feeling that made you feel like you were in an alien environment.
It's auditory vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for this score, he listened to a lot of Ralph Vaughan Williams. Mm-hmm. And there's a Vaughan Williams symphony that has sort of a primordial version of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's different in the symphony, and they're just little bits of those sort of moods of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, those things, which are also sort of reminiscent of Vertigo. But everything's reminiscent of something. It's all how you put it together.
Except for one thing.
What?
To get it to his point.
The cheesy lyrics?
Sean Cassidy's lyrics for Aaliyah's theme, which was rebranded Star Before Time?
I looked that up in the liner notes.
Branded is a strong word.
But, you know, wasn't the idea that this was going to become a top 10 hit and they put it out as a 45?
Well, they tried to make it a top 10 hit.
Well, that's the thing about Jerry's career that kind of frustrated his attempts to, or his chances to win Oscars, is that he was a real interior composer and a real master of moods and colors and ideas and textures and affect and things that are subliminal, and they don't quite mm-hmm. grab the audience the same way that in the big famous John Williams scores. You do leave Star Trek humming the theme, but you don't really leave Alien humming the theme. Mm. You don't really leave Poltergeist humming the theme. We do, but most. Well, that one has a very beautiful lullaby, but he was like a method composer, and in fact, in interviews, he was sort of notoriously vague and a little bit cranky when you asked him how did he come up with this. We have journalist friends who said that he would remember on a movie, like, who he liked, who he hated, how much he was paid, where he wrote it, when he wrote it, what was going on, everything about the movie. And then you ask, well, why'd you do that theme? He goes, I don't know, I heard it that way. Mm-hmm. So on Star Trek, he said, like, I don't know, it's in 3 a lot because I heard it in 3. Mm-hmm. The theme is in 6-8, and mm-hmm. Aaliyah's theme is in 3-4. There are things we can describe musically that would take a long time and not be as satisfying to your audience. But he was a little odd that way. I can tell you how much he got paid, by the way.
Do you want how much did he get paid?
He got paid. Now, this is not all the royalties from the publishing, right, but as a creative fee, he got $50,000
to compose that score.
That's considering how
that was the high end at the time.
The longevity of it, that ain't a lot of money, McGee.
That ended up being a lot of money with all the
every time ancillary, yeah.
Well, every time
because the Next Generation,
yeah,
I mean,
right,
every time they use that theme, he gets.
Star Trek is probably the piece of music that survives Goldsmith, and it's sad to say because he did have at least one hit early in his career, this Dr. Kildare mm-hmm. song, and for a while he was kind of integrating, like, you know, pop and rock, like in the Flint scores, maybe more effectively than a lot of the other composers of his generation, and he did movies like Chinatown and Patton, which for a long time, you know, you would see movies, and he even had to do this himself, where like they'd say, well, I want you to make a reference to Patton, you know, put the Patton theme in here. And others, I remember watching WKRP in Cincinnati, and they had a, you know, some character, you know, was supposed to be remembering Lost Glories, and they play the little Patton, you know, the trumpet. So I, you know, would look for that. That has completely disappeared because nobody now remembers any movies made prior to 10 years ago. So a lot of Goldsmith's music has really disappeared. And it's really sad because he's one of the great, you know, I think 20th century American composers. But Star Trek, because that theme got used in Star Trek The Next Generation and it wound up becoming kind of the official Star Trek theme. And it's still, used in association with the franchise. That's kind of the one piece of music where people, if you ask someone, they're going to remember that. They know what that is.
Yeah, he was famous for, or he wasn't, no one knew really of him, but he did the Waltons theme, which mm-hmm. was a big hit. Mm-hmm. He did the Barnaby Jones theme.
Right. Yeah. Police Story.
Right. He also like sort of to the day he died sort of said he didn't really get Star Trek. Like we have a friend who was his agent in the last chunk of his career, and our friend Richard Kraft told a story where he went over to Jerry's house. I might have told this on the show last time, he was starting on Insurrection, and Jerry was in the process of scoring the opening chase where Data goes a little crazy. And it's missing all these visual effects. So when they're just watching the video, it's a little incomprehensible. And so Richard says, like, what's going on here? And Jerry says, I have no idea.
But, you know, if that's in fact true, if he didn't know what Star Trek was, I like his idea of what Star Trek was very, very much. And how that influenced, actually, our perception to what Star Trek is.
Yes, and that's a larger topic, which is that, I can't remember what the joke is. It's like Star Trek as a feature film. Wait a minute, but isn't Star Trek supposed to be slow and boring? And maybe you guys will take offense at that, but Star Trek was always kind of the anti-movie. I had I'll talk out of school again. I had one of the few meetings I've ever had in my life, like 8 or 10 years ago, with some guy at Bad Robot. And I don't remember, I won't even tell how or why that came about, but he said, yeah, you know, he's no longer there. Like Star Trek to us is kind of like Pepsi. It's just, it's like this great brand that everyone knows, but it's just not Coke and it's never going to be. And so they're rolling their eyes here, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's they tried to make it into Coke and they found out they just couldn't. And so
was a real disaster,
yeah,
too.
But bringing it back to Jerry, he, you know, that's the perfect theme for Star Trek because it's about exploring. It's like a pacifist march. You know, it's for the future. It's for this glittering future, a successful future, this optimistic future. But it's not quite warlike. It's not mm-hmm. it's not militaristic, even though it. And the way he in the score, it's really quite brilliant. The way he had.
It's not a march. It's a processional.
Yeah,
it's a celebration rather than a.
I mean,
direction.
Yes, you could say that. I mean, it's a 6-8 march.
No, you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. And then the way he has these figures, so it's a way to have it be propulsive and melodic without just having someone slamming on snare drums. He doesn't use those are there as accents, but it's not the focus. So, it is a strange movie, and it's sort of the last of its kind in that, as Jeff says, it was. These sequences are kind of incomplete, and they need the music not just to sort of push us along, but to actually fill in the concept. And it's part of an artifact of how they wrote the movie, which I would characterize as incredibly stupid. And it's partly an artifact of Bob Wise and the movies he used to make. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the end of that era where, it's got an overture and it's this.
Second to last overture, if you don't count Hateful Eight.
Was it after Black Hole?
No, it was before Black Hole. Yeah. Black Hole was the last overture.
Yeah, it was a different era when they still had this vestige of, it's this, you know, this big, long Ben-Hur type movie that you're going to go to and, you know, wear your nice clothes to the theater. And it was really that the last of its kind as opposed to being the first of a bunch of, you know, 12-year-old kids waiting around for the blockbuster. It's not an action adventure. It's very cerebral and
bouncing back to Ailea's theme, which, you know, I think there's various recordings of the song that Ailea's theme is, but that's another one of these pieces that they recorded several times because they had nothing else to record. And it was very, I think, am I wrong, that he sort of came up with that theme? That was his first completed theme. Right?
I think so. I haven't looked at it. Yeah.
But it's related somehow to the other thematic pieces in the film. But on its own, it's this amazingly beautiful sort of lyrical, even without words, piece. And you would think that it wouldn't go along with this film, but it completely does. And the fact that they use it for the overture to set the mood kind of tells you more about what the bigger picture of it is, at least in Goldsmith's mind, I think.
I think, too, also, when we did the show the last time on the music, we all talked about our favorite music from the history of Star Trek. And it was rightly pointed out to us that no one said, how could no one have said Ilya's theme? And, of course, they were right, because Ilya's theme is just such a beautiful, brilliant piece of music. And it kind of, you know, it's not as memorable as something like, in some ways, as, you know, we talked about, I guess, you know, even the Klingon theme, you know, it's hummable. And we talked about, you know, the Doomsday Machine and all these different pieces of music that we talked about. But yet, Ilya's theme is such a stunning and effective and just lyrical piece of music.
And to me, it's most closely related to the original TOS theme. It is sort of in that same vein, actually.
You mean the long line?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that people overlook it because they overlook Ilya. I mean, there's no real affection for that character.
I don't know about that.
I like Ilya.
I don't know about
that. I like,
you know,
Persis. God, you know.
I think it's just most people just don't notice anything.
And it's not even really, there's no real love story in the movie.
There is, actually.
Well,
Decker Unit.
Have you seen the film?
Right.
Lucas?
All right, so if you want to pick a fight about this movie, I've seen this movie more times than I can count, as we all have here. But, you know, I always will watch it. I have a lot of affection for it. I love the design, the music, the world they create. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I still find it so profoundly disappointing and flawed. And I think that to deny that is just a little cuckoo. I mean, I can tell you exactly
where. I deny nothing.
Yep. I'll tell you exactly where it goes.
Everything.
I'll tell you exactly where it goes bad. Now, there are a lot of things that go bad about it, but just as like in the narrative, so they do the transmission and they start going through the cloud. Mm-hmm. Now we have 5 minutes of we're going in the cloud, listening to music, watching people's faces, looking at the pictures.
Right.
Amazing visual effects.
But we're also looking at the pictures.
Yes. It stops and then they go again. There's another 5 minute piece. So now it's 10 minutes of narratively the same thing,
right.
10 minutes. And then they stop. Then Ilya, they have the thing with the probe and she gets zapped. And then what happens? They go forward and it's another 5 minutes. So you have a 20-minute chunk of this movie as we're getting to the end of Act 2. And it's 15 minutes of watching the stupid pictures and nothing. It's just, it's not how you write a movie.
Well, because it's an experience.
It's just bad writing, man. There's no way.
I think you're thinking
Mark,
of it in the
don't
wrong way.
Don't you do
way.
This for a real? You make a living writing
scripts. It's painterly.
It's not good.
I mean, I think it is.
It's defective.
It was an attempt to do you know, their version of 2001, which is also very, you know, first person.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they but, know. But they it's, knew
but
they
it's
messed
hard.
Up.
You couldn't combine. You know, the sterility, there was kind of this icy brilliance of 2001 that was this whole other aspect of the film that Star Trek is the opposite of. It's Star Trek's all about emotions and getting you in the faces of the characters, and there was always a big schism between, and they talked about that during the making, like that, you know, there's a line or DeForest Kelly's like, you have to show close-ups of the actors. Why aren't you, you know, that's how we did it on TV, and that's what we kind of all loved about the TV show. So it's this weird mix of, you know, the kind of attempt at the sterility Kubrick and emotion.
I'll tell you something about that. It's worth hearing. This one. So in that Return to Tomorrow book that we published, that oral history, Leonard Nimoy at one point, at the time, in 79 or 80, says, you know, the first time I realized had a problem is I had a meeting at Bob Wise's condo in Century City. And I walked in, and the decor was so modern and severe and like impersonal and cold. I thought, uh-oh. And he was right. It's Bob Wise. He was a lovely man, but he had that aesthetic. And it worked for the Andromeda Strain, but I don't think it worked for
Star Trek. But it's the last of the big films to have a Kubrickian influence. It's like, at that point, Star Wars began to influence all the subsequent science fiction, but this is like almost the last big blockbuster to where 2001 was this dramatic influence on. And you can see it. And like 2001, you know, it's brilliant in a lot of ways, and it's slow in others. And but you know, the aesthetic is forward thinking and unique. And
but no matter how we consider about the pace, we can all agree that the music binds it together.
Are you trying to get back on topic?
I am, actually.
Right. Okay. Never
It's funny because the you know,
it
even,
binds the galaxy together. Right. It,
you know, Star Trek after by sort of this course correction with the Wrath of Khan, you know, Star Trek. Even it got back to the character interaction, but it became, you know, this rigid formula where you had to have like an evil villain to be destroyed, which was the they never did that in the original series.
They
it
did
was all
sometimes.
they would have a villain, but it was there was always some kind of motivation. And the most memorable episodes were about discovering that this monster or whatever, you know, wasn't what we thought it was. And that's what
like the Doomsday Machine.
The V'ger was all about that. It was a rehash of previous episode ideas.
The key idea to Star Trek is that you win by understanding, and you don't win through violence. And that's not something that you
that's
can sell
a much
to kids
bigger discussion
as
that I would happily like have with you as to whether or not I actually think that's necessarily true. Because I think that Captain Kirk in that original series was much more of a John F. Kennedy figure. There was there was a lot less, you know, peace, love, and understanding back then than we might think, as they like to say. But I will say, in Star Trek: The Motion Picture's defense, that number one, that score, that beautiful score, would not have been possible with any of the other films. That's like number one, regardless of how that movie was developed, and the process of shooting it and when things were available, it wouldn't have fit. And I think that what the score really does is it elevates that film and
absolutely,
it elevates the visuals. And as Darren says, it turns it into an experience. I'm like one of those lunatics who really loves the motion picture. I think that the director's edition is a great improvement because I think it fixes a lot of the pace. I think that there are some problems that persist regardless because simply you can't create something where there was nothing before. But everything that I loved about that movie, I think, is on even more display and without losing what's really special about that score. The fact that you can just sit in it and listen to it and feel something from it, yet at the same time not feel like the music is just dictating an emotional experience in lieu of anything interesting or good happening on screen. It's actually quite well matched to what's happening on screen.
But yeah, how much better would it have been with the Herbie Hancock score?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think what Goldsmith, it fits in with kind of the opening narration of Star Trek. It's all about strange new worlds. And there's you know, Goldsmith creates not only this entire world with this score, but also these kind of individual environments and worlds, that, like we were talking about earlier, the Vulcan world, the Klingon world, the Federation, the Enterprise, V'ger. They're all very distinct and very immersive. You just kind of exist inside them when you're kind of experiencing the movie.
You know, people say it's slow. Some people say it's boring. Could you imagine what this film would have been without the Jerry Goldsmith score?
No.
Is there a score that elevates a movie? I mean, you could count them on your hand. Psycho, Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
Star Wars,
which are completely elevated by the score. I mean, Star Trek: The Motion Picture belongs in that pantheon. That movie is nothing without the score.
Right. There's a quote from Danny Elfman where he says that, you know, prior to like Dolby sound coming in, that like the music was like 50% of the impact of a motion picture, and that's I'd say with this movie, it's like 60 to 70%. It really drives the movie. Yeah, you can't imagine the movie without it. You can look at those. There's that kind of teaser thing that has music from Marathon Man. Yeah,
right.
And so that gives you a little idea. It seems a little bit more ordinary and maybe just like a straight action film with that music. But it gives you an idea what it might have been. And,
Miss Uhura.
Yeah,
Uhura, I think.
Or, who else could it have been at that time, if not Jerry or Williams?
John Barry. But he was busy doing the Black Hole.
Yeah. That would not have been it. Well,
I love the Black Hole. Yeah. Black Hole's better than Star Trek. No.
score.
But I love that score for Black Hole.
Both themes.
Yeah.
Because the big 80s guys were a little bit after that. I'm trying to think who were the big name composers. Maurice Jarre, Elmer Bernstein.
David Shire.
I don't know. You know, those were great composers. It's a perfect
Shire
score.
Shire had done, actually, you know, The Hindenburg, which is a big epic movie for Robert Wise. So I wonder if he was ever considered.
Probably not, you know.
I think Goldsmith, you know, like I said, he was the natural. He was the science fiction, you know, kind of brand name composer, the guy that you associated with big science fiction movies at the time.
Now, how did it affect Jerry? Because, of course, we all know the stories about how Robert Wise had a hand carry the print to the premiere because it literally they printed it just in time because that's how close to the release, and that they were that famous picture, which I love, of all the film cans on a soundstage at Paramount, because they almost couldn't make the prints in time to the first prints were going to New York, and then to the Westwood screenings they were hand carrying them from the lot to Westwood to make
it. And some original screenings on the opening day started without the final can being there.
Yes, because of course they're reel changes, so they would get the first couple of reels, and then they would be printing the last reel and sending it to the theaters just in time to make the reel change.
Suboptimal.
I mean, this is what Star Trek was up against.
It's a photo finish, literally.
So what you know? How did that impact? You know, at the very end, you know, on Jerry and you know, was he able to make any adjustments in the music for the final visual effects? And you know,
no, they couldn't even adjust the movie for the visual effects. No. That's what we were talking about, and that's what I think hurts the film. I mean, this is, brings back to the music. So when they cut together, when they got those effects for the cloud, and that's the cloud, and then I forget the name, V'ger flyover and the force field, they had no time to cut them, and they couldn't cut them because the music was locked to the rough cut.
Right.
So you're watching the rough cut for those 20 minutes.
The funny thing, and that amazes me, is we just sort of found out this in the past, 6 months, or this footage from the Klingon sequence kind of resurfaced that showed that there was actually a little bit more to that all the Klingon ships were firing. And that just stuns me, because of all the sequences in the movie, that was literally the one done at the very last minute, and how they had any time to like think about or adjust that. But whatever Goldsmith scored, there's no edits in that music. He scored the finished sequence, so that, you know, they kind of made those cuts. Yeah,
in the theatrical version.
Yeah,
there are edits.
But you couldn't. You had to make those edits very thoughtful with the music. Yeah. Or else it would sound terrible.
Absolutely.
He finished recording November 29th.
Oh, my God. And the movie came out December 7th.
Yeah.
See, what people don't understand, today, like, literally, special effects companies are delivering days before the press screening. Mm-hmm. Because of digital, they're finishing movies like a day or two before the movie screens. And I've heard of them making changes even after the press screening,
before. And that's, you know, that's why, and it drives, you know, John Williams crazy. It was driving him crazy on The Force Awakens that with digital editing now, that you're just constantly changing individual sequences so much. I mean, Goldsmith was dealing with, you know, a crazy situation, but he was still working with sort of completed sequences. He just wasn't seeing everything. But he I don't know what he would have done. And that, to me, is why, like, a lot of film music now is so boring, because there's no time to devote any thought to it.
It's so remarkable, which is what you said. I mean, you think of this photochemical process where, I mean, he finishes at the end of November, and then the premiere in Washington at the Smithsonian was a week before. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's incredible. And what an accomplishment.
It also explains why there were never any 70mm prints of the movie.
And very few sound effects. The sound design.
Well, and that's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, a lot of these science fiction movies, the music gets buried by sound effects. That tends to get the mix tends to get the emphasis. But they didn't have time. It's something you rectified in your director's edition, you and your guys. But that there's so little sound effects because they didn't have time to put sound effects
in. Yeah, there's not a whole sound environment, and that's another big difference. That's something that was, you know, at work in the original series. The sound effects were very discreet, and so music could be more at the forefront and drive a lot more. And you know, the music in something like Planet of the Apes or Star Trek the Motion Picture works as a like sound effects too, mm-hmm. because it helps create the culture, right. and the whole environment, the future, everything that you're kind of looking at reinforces.
You know
that.
What I found fascinating? I just read Bill Hunt wrote about this. I guess when they just re-released in 4K Batman, the 1989 Batman. Mm-hmm. Tim Burton went in and actually replaced, they did a new sound mix, some of the sound effects because some of the effects that were in the original Batman were just stock from other movies. They didn't have time. And this was 89, biggest blockbuster of the year. They didn't have time to create the sound effects. So they were just, it wasn't the Wilhelm scream, but they were pulling stuff from other movies to throw in because, and here we are 30 years later, and he was creating proprietary new sound effects because it was something that always bothered him, that he wanted unique effects rather than just doing from a library.
That's amazing. But if he actually had brought in the Wilhelm scream, choice. Jaron, I have a question for you, which is, when you were doing the director's edition, when you were editing that film, doing such a remarkable job with it, what was your approach to editing the music and kind of preserving what Goldsmith had done for the theatrical cut?
Well, Mike Matesino and Robert Wise worked together to create the final cut of the director's edition. But for those, specifically the extended Goldsmith pieces. There was every effort to, because they were written this way in sections, to cut a section here and there, to get half a section and take that out, to try and pare it down to the, you know, as much as you could without breaking the whole structure of it. And when Mike talked to Jerry Goldsmith later and told him what was going on, Jerry said, "Oh, thank God, because that's exactly what I intended to, you know, to be able to give you some flexibility in it, because it's the process of writing for Blank Leader, you know, let him sort of go a little bit wild, and but he was able to structure it enough so that you can take pieces out." And not have everything go into the dumper.
Yeah, Jerry would use like these like rhythmic motifs and ostinatos, repeated phrases. I actually asked Fred Steiner about that because Fred Steiner did that. Obviously, he worked on the movie, but on the original show, I asked him why he used all these repeating phrases, and he said that he did that intentionally to make the music easier to edit because you're going to be
so you can add or subtract.
Yeah, exactly. I actually made I just want to boast that I made a little contribution to the director's cut because they kind of extended the scene where Ailea is like healing Chekhov.
Yes.
And again, there were very little or no sound effects, and there's this whole scene where she's using her, powers, and there was no music there. And I suggested to Mike Matesino this would be a great place. That was a place where that theme could actually function and kind of show her abilities. And Mike found a version of her theme that hadn't actually been used in the movie, so. Very proud of that.
I did want to plug something that your listeners will find interesting if they're sort of more musicologist types, that there was a thesis written on this score that in the 1980s, the writer let us scan and put at Film Score Monthly. So if you go to filmscoremonthly.com and look under resources, it's called Star Trek Thesis. And it's very long and very detailed, and it has musical examples. And I think
folks it's great. He gets into
that.
All the kind of influences and the Vaughan Williams stuff, shows you where all that came from.
What do you think the legacy of this film score is, and how do you think Jerry's subsequent efforts on the franchise compared?
I love his score to Star Trek V, and it's a completely different approach, and it sort of shows you maybe what he might have done if Star Trek the Motion Picture had been in a completely different movie and had been a more action character-based.
Star Trek V is the Western version.
And his style had evolved a lot by the time he made that movie. It's a very different approach. But I love that score. His other efforts for like the Next Generation movies, I don't love as much. Although all of them are, he was a master, and anything he wrote generally was probably better than what somebody else would have done. Apparently, when he was working on Star Trek V, he had written some different arrangement of the end titles. Mm. And he had a orchestrator who will now
Nancy
Beach. She had worked on Leviathan. And she arranged this, and there was some technical mistake in it. And they started to record it, and apparently it was like really fascinating and like this super cool thing, but the orchestra couldn't play it because it's the way it had been orchestrated. And Goldsmith yelled at her and never hired her again. But that seemed to be almost like a turning point where he wasn't going to invest a lot into the end title sequences. Mm-hmm. So the end title sequences for most of his later Star Trek scores, you know, are just straight, like, here's the maybe one other theme I wrote for it, but it's just that same version of the Star Trek march.
I don't know if I read that much into it. I think that if you just look at the more recent movies and the way they're cut, not even the J.J. movies, but the 90s movies, mm-hmm. they're just faster. You know, they'll do a space shot early in the movie. You got to do it around 11 minutes in, da 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 da, and then they cut right to the bridge and, well, where are we going now?
Yeah, they're much shorter.
It's just something that happens. I don't think this movie is really... I don't think it's influential. I mean, I think that we like it, but I think that if you want to look at the movies that were influential, it's like The Terminator, Aliens, you know, the Cameron stuff, the violence, upping the action, upping the violence, upping the visceral nature of the... I think that's what we're still living in. And I think that this was really like the last 50s roadshow movie ever.
Yeah, interesting.
I would totally agree.
So, Ashley, we'll wrap up by asking you, what do you think the legacy is, and what do you think of Jerry's post-Star Trek, the motion picture Star Trek scores?
Well, honestly, I think, other than obviously the Alexander Courage, no piece of music is more associated with Star Trek in any form than the theme that Jerry Goldsmith wrote for Star Trek, the motion picture. I think it's iconic. And, you know, I think it elevated some of the again, he elevates everything, but he elevated some of those next generation movies in ways that, frankly, I don't know that they deserved to be elevated. And if you want to see the difference between a movie that is striving to be great, that's truly elevated by its score, and a movie that is just kind of a movie and has a score that should elevate it, it's Star Trek the Motion Picture versus, say, Star Trek Nemesis. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think that the way that I think about Star Trek is largely informed by that score. Mm-hmm. And the way that I remember going to see that movie when I was, you know, but a lad. And a lot of my feelings about that film do come from that score. Sure. That sense of, you know, things are very large and they're frightening and there's a funky bass line off the starboard bow. And where did that come from? To this day, I didn't know where that funky bass line came from. And
play that
now
funky bass line, white boy.
That's right. play the funky bass line, V'ger.
Wow, yeah. I mean, God, what a... Remember the first LP? You all own it?
Of course. I remember it well.
And that gorgeous Bob Peacock. Fantastic. Was that a success in stores? Do you know?
I don't know. It was. I know that Columbia Records paid $650,000 to Paramount to basically advance them the recording costs.
Right. I'm pretty sure there's a quote from Goldsmith saying it was one of his better selling.
Yeah,
albums,
it didn't sell as well as Star Wars, which is what they were hoping for. But basically, Columbia Records wrote him a giant check to pay for the recording, and then it sort of fell out of print, and there were some licensing issues that I personally fixed. You're welcome, Star Trek fans. And I'll tell you how I fixed it. There was such a big fight between Sony Music and Paramount over... I can't get into it. It's not appropriate. But it was something was done in a way that was not good, and it was unresolved, and it was always going to be a fight. And I was the one who said, why don't we just leave it alone? Let's just agree we're never going to solve that and do a new version, give it to La La Land, and you split the baby in two. Hmm. You just split the right royalties and just agree that we're never going to solve this old problem. And kicking the can down the road works.
You're the Solomon of
Star Trek.
Dude,
it worked. I fixed this. Wow. Thank you, Lucas,
because we're indebted to you for La La Land putting out this remarkable three-disc album, which has all the music from Star Trek the Motion Picture, much of it unused as well. And it's given us many, many, many hours of pleasure.
Transfer to 192K so that dogs can be impressed.
Well, there you go. Okay, on that note, I want to thank our guests, Lucas Kendall, Jeff Bond, and Ashley E. Miller for joining us here on Inglourious Trexperts. And if you're a fan of this podcast, you may want to check out Electric Surge's other podcasts, like The 4:30 Movie every Friday, in which a group of writer and producers curate fantasy theme weeks of classic movies and overlooked masterpieces like Howard the Duck. right, Ashley?
No. Yeah.
Also, this summer on the CW, don't forget to check out the second season of Dean Devlin's fantasy series, The Outpost, and the new sci-fi action-adventure series from creator executive producer me, Pandora. Also, look for Best Movies Never Made every Monday, wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as the new Star Wars podcast, The Rebel and the Rogue, every Thursday night. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, and you can follow us in Inglourious Trek on Twitter or Inglourious Trexperts on Instagram. Also, a very special thanks to Bill Ritter, wearing his Inglourious Trexperts shirt, available at Inglourious Trek, and everyone here at Electric Surge Network, including producer Natalie Mascali and Cynthia Hodge. So until next Saturday, keep on trekking, and gloriously, of course. Engage. This podcast is a production of the Electric Surge Network.